everybody. Welcome back to The Therapy Show with Wendy and Scott. I'm Scott Johnson. That's Wendy Dunford, my sister. Hi, Wendy.
Hello.
I don't know why I feel like I have to make that clear on these episodes that we're related.
That we're related.
And just directly related.
So that they know when today we talk about genetic factors.
Yeah, I guess, right?
Somehow it doesn't work with you and I.
Yeah, I don't know what happened there. So anyway, welcome back, everybody. It's good to be here. We got a big topic today that reminds me of some of the things that matter to me most at this particular point of my life, which is trying to figure out my place in the crazy that is, you know, 2014 world that we live in. And by that, I mean things like just the sheer amount of stress that swirls around everything that didn't kind of used to exist. So we've talked in previous episodes about, you know, kids having stresses they didn't have to deal with before and parents putting new stresses in their heads while they're little and things like that.
Right.
But when I grew up, it felt like there was just not that much to worry about. It was kind of like go and play, go do what you want to do, hang out with your friends, have fun, do your homework, come home. To your parents, do your stuff, whatever. It was just a pretty straightforward kind of scenario. And there wasn't a lot of outside pressure to fill those traditional off times. If you weren't at work while you were a teenager or something, or while you weren't in school, this other time was time that you would determine what to do with. And you wouldn't have 50 other influences trying to tell you what to do with that time.
Right.
You might have a friend that says, we need to go to the 7-Eleven and buy a whatever. But that's different. That was the thing you could say, nah, I'm good. You guys go ahead. Or yeah, sure. I've got a few minutes. Let's go.
Right.
Today we are tethered 24/7 by devices, phones, smartphones, tablets, computers, the internet. Some still use beepers, I suppose. Right. Some doctor's still getting beeped and told that he has a baby coming or whatever. But those things are constantly there, constantly available. And when somebody leaves their office at 5, which even that doesn't happen very much anymore, and they go home, they can check texts, messages, tweets, Facebook posts, whatever their connection to the world is. They can do that even in the car before they freaking get there. I mean, I am guilty of this where I was in a meeting just last week and I was expecting a very important client text. I got a text during the meeting because I felt my pants vibrate, but I didn't know if I could check it there or not. So I kept having the meeting, ran out of there, got in the car, put my headphones on, immediately asked Siri to read my most recent text, which I can do hands-free in the car now.
Yeah.
So reading my most recent text. Okay. Then she reads it. And there it is. And I can call that guy right now. I can, you know, a lot of people say, oh, it's a real boon. Here's drive time. It's usually such a freaking waste.
Yeah.
But now you can use it for all this productivity. But then you can get home and you got to check your email. And then somebody calls you or texts you again, says, did you check this? Did you see that? Oh, I don't know. Let me get to my office and look. And that happens to me. I'll find myself in here at 8:30 for no reason on a Sunday night because I'm trying to deal with some issue that 20 years ago, nobody would have cared. They wouldn't have pressured you to do anything about it. You just deal with it when you get to work on Monday.
Right.
So
the expectation totally shifts. Like, why haven't you texted me back? It's been 14 seconds.
Right. And you feel it all the time.
Yeah.
That phone could go off any second. That thing could tell me that I got to be someplace. And if I don't answer it or ignore that text, or even if I put it on airplane mode and shut it all down, I am somehow now delinquent in my ability to respond. Somebody's going to be ticked that I didn't get back to them.
Do you tie it directly to making clients happy, making money? Like, is there more to it than just, I'm going to lose a client if I don't respond right away, or this is going to cost me money, or they may not go with me because I'm not as responsive as someone else.
It's this competitive drive thing where if I want to be able to maintain whatever it is I'm doing and still stay ahead of the crowd or keep my edge above whoever else is trying to perhaps, you know, do what I'm doing and therefore obtain revenue that I would normally be getting. That's the pressure.
Right.
It isn't just, ooh, I wonder what so-and-so's up to. That stuff isn't.
No. But I'm wondering, is there more than that? Because that I think is a given in most business senses, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there are people who are not running a business that probably still feel similar pressures socially, maybe? I don't know.
Maybe. So let's say you're a 20-year-old female college student.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not referring to anyone I'm related to here, except maybe I am.
Because you just dropped the 2 years.
She,
make it 20.
This person is, always, phone's always there. Has to be. And if it's not, there's real anxiety in that face.
Right.
So if that thing's lost, if it broke, if it's in the wash, if you left it in your car, even if it's just across the room, difficult for that person to sit very long without just have to go get that freaking phone. And that pressure, while it may be, there may be a transition period here of professional things or whatever coming into play more, but most of it is social stuff.
Yeah.
It is that friend getting back to you. It is that party happening later and whether I'm going or not. That all depends on whether, quote unquote, Amy or whatever name I'm going to make up here says she's going, you know, whatever those pressures are. I feel like it's, that's happening there. It's not happening with me on the social side of it, but there's this feeling, and I don't know how you stop this in an open market competitive society where that's the basis, at least here in these United States,
yeah,
to grow and to compete is to have an advantage. And the advantage sometimes comes from, I'm willing to stay up that much later. I'm willing to be that much more accessible on my phone. I'm willing to be that much more on tap all the time,
right,
in order to compete with whoever I'm competing with. And I feel like those are new pressures. And yeah, they're new because the technology and the changes have allowed it. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Now, would they have done it in the 40s if they could have? Probably.
Right. And did they do it in another version? Yes.
Probably, yeah.
Right.
I mean, there was a lot of sort of...
There's like, many dads children never saw.
Kind of the Mad Men era of...
Right. Work the
new
late.
Yes. And the new pressure was, I really should be at that bar with that client drinking now.
Yeah, or playing golf.
But I really don't want to, but I got it. You know, like you still feel those pressures and those tensions. Right. It's just that, and in a lot of ways, I feel those same kinds of pressures and tensions, but I've gotten so wound up in this new stuff that I don't even have time to stress about those.
Right.
It's like, hey, Scott, are you going to Phoenix for the Comic-Con down there this week? No, how the hell am I going to that with everything I'm doing, right? I don't have time to go,
right,
even though that may actually be something I want to do. But it's really hard for me to just say, nope, shutting it down, let's go. Let's go get a flight. Let's get out of here. Right. To me, it's a bigger prospect than that because there's so many little things and threads and things going on that I am tethered to all the time. And I think I'm a mild case.
Right.
Because I kind of run my own show and there's built-in stresses with that. But there are people out there who have every pressure from the top all the way down and sideways and left ways and right ways.
So it's the rat race. Maybe it looks a little different.
Yeah.
It's kind of the same thing. But at what we're going to sort of focus on today is a little bit of the consequence of that and how it plays out. But I got to ask you another question. When you are, I mean, do you ever just get burned out? Do you ever just go, I'm done. I have a list mile long of things I'm supposed to do. And not even that I don't want to, that I can't do it.
Right.
I cannot open that email. I cannot function. And you sort of fizzle.
Yes.
Right? Okay.
So this happened this week. I'll tell you a quick story.
Yeah.
Real bad. Too much stuff going on. Started to feel like I would start something and then immediately have to go to something else. Yeah. I'm like, where did I end with that? Oh shoot. Now I don't remember.
Yeah.
Laundry list this big of things I have to get done. I'm being real arbitrary about which ones I'm picking. It got to the point where I was like, this is not, nobody is winning here.
Yeah.
This is just a big loss. So I'm going to play Diablo 3 for the next hour, which I did. And that's a big stress relief for me to be able to just pull away and do something mindless, play a video game or read a book or something, just get away and put myself in another place for a little while. That helps. But at some point I think that's bad because if I rely on that, isn't that a kind of a problem? Because I turn to it when things are craziest and instead of, I don't know, instead of looking for opportunities to get ahead of the game, I'm kind of like, I'll just do that because that's easy and I can get away and just do it.
Right. No, I think you are, the exact reason you do it is because your brain has quit. Like your ability to give clear attention to something, to anything is so depleted, you can't do it. So then you still have Mr. Voice in the back of your head going, you are blowing this. Like you should really get that thing done. But your actual ability, your executive functioning prefrontal cortex is tired or burnt through or whatever it is. So you have to be somewhere completely at one spot. And that's what Diablo does or anything, you know, binging on a TV show or something. You get lost all your attention goes into a specific world, right? Mm-hmm. So it gives your brain, the scattered brain, a rest. But it also explains why people are sort of compulsively doing this thing.
Well, I was going to say, what is the difference between that and me turning to a bottle of pills?
Right.
Which I don't do. But if I did, what's the difference?
Well, the difference is, you know, ultimately the outcome is not, you know, as dangerous for your future success.
Yeah.
However, there are definitely folks who are going to sort of fall into the pit of watching every episode of
whatever.
Whatever.
Sure.
I mean, I haven't, I know, world out there, you're probably freaked out by this, but I have not seen that show.
What show? Breaking Bad?
Breaking Bad. I couldn't
think of
the name.
None of it?
I haven't seen one. And
it's too bad. It's really good.
I know, because at one point I will start and then I will fall into the pit.
You will, because you'll be really into it and you won't be able to stop. And binge watching, which is a relatively new term, is a real thing.
It's a real thing. And it didn't exist before because you couldn't do it.
Right.
And now you can do it. So to me, it's just another drug on the market. We're going to talk about how the brain works a little bit today. And,
sure.
And
this is, let's make this clear. This is not an attempt, at least I don't think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but this is not Wendy's attempt to say, modern culture, facets of that culture, television, movies, games, whatever, are all
evil.
New drugs on the market in the sense that they're these awful new things that people have to contend with. It is that our brains work in a certain way. And then when it used to be that everybody would gather around the water cooler on Monday to talk about what happened on Friday's episode of The Dukes of Hazzard,
yeah.
They did that because it was the only chance you ever got to see it. You were at their whim if they ran a bunch of reruns. It just was a... What a weird, odd time. It was just like, here's a thing. You saw it. You could share the experience, and then you moved on.
Now, just imagine you then.
Yeah.
We're all gathering as a family, watching Family Ties at 7 p.m. on Thursdays.
I remember that. Must-see TV.
Imagine if we just shot you forward to 2014 and said, you can freeze it. You can... I mean, my kids are always in the car like, play that song again if it's on the radio. And I'm like, yeah,
it doesn't work that way, son.
And thinking about that, remember when you used to record?
Yeah.
And you try to get the DJ's voice as minimized on there, you know? I mean, what a different place. And I think part of that is, you know, we're not quite adapted fully to manage all the stimulus. But really what this has to do more with is stress management, life management. So no, there's nothing wrong with watching your favorite show to escape. But what ends up happening for folks is if they don't find ways to really feel grounded or... you know, essentially to stop multitasking. We think we're good at this and we're not. So when you were saying, I got this project, and I do all these things, I never fully give attention to something. And eventually you have that feeling like no one's winning. This isn't working.
Master of nothing. What's the phrase? It's mediocre at everything. Master of nothing. Whatever it is. Whatever it is. Where you can't, if you try to do it all, they're all kind of average. If you do one really well, then it's awesome.
And then I'm going to throw this in. I would assume most people are sleep deprived.
Yeah.
And there is a chemical reason that is pretty terrible in this regard too, is so we work longer hours, we sleep less, partly because we don't shut off in enough time to get restful sleep, or we're stressed, which keeps us awake. Anxiety's, you know, rampant or whatever. And then stress actually increases, or sorry, lack of sleep actually increases levels of cortisol, which we're going to talk about cortisol, which is the stress hormone. So you're actually kind of creating this mess, right? And then you get to a point where your brain sort of freezes up on you.
All right.
And that's when you go play Diablo. Or for some, it might be push through it, eventually, you know, sort of crash. And you can see why, you know, getting drunk after that might feel good, or watching, you know, whatever, or taking something to just not be in that state that is, I got to produce, I got to create, I got to whatever.
I mean, for some people, this is, I'm going to go run for 2 hours.
Right.
I'm going to go, I don't know, the seemingly otherwise healthy things. But are you being used in the same way, kind of escape hatches from this craziness of their day?
Right.
So for me, you know, I don't, like, I'll even have this problem. It's funny because sometimes I use video games as an escape from the stress. But there are times where part of my job is to review them and have them and play them and experience them and then talk about them. I might be presented with too many of those to choose from.
Right.
And I don't want to do any of them.
Right. You want to watch the Andy Griffith Show.
Yeah. I have all the games and then go, I'd rather go, like the kids just binge watched the entirety of the the Dick Van Dyke Show from the 50s and the 60s. And the whole thing's on Netflix. So every night the kids watch two or three of those episodes for like 2 months straight or something.
Right.
And they were way into it and totally into it. And it just occurred to me, I'm like, wow, weird. This is a show from a time when there were three networks at most. Mm-hmm. You're lucky if you got to watch any episode of anything once or twice. It was just a thing you knew about or whatever. I mean, I wasn't even alive when these shows were on, so I don't know. But now they can just sit there and just pound through it. And behind it all, there's 50 other choices just like those, just sitting on Netflix going, here, binge on me.
Right.
It's weird. It's like that thing you've said before about the whole too much choice thing.
Yeah. Kind of paralyzes you.
There are so many choices right now.
Right.
So many. And I have this thing at night where I'm like, well, I don't feel tired. I could watch a billion things that are on my wish list on Netflix.
Right.
I could watch 50 more things that are on my wish list on Amazon Prime. Or I could play a game over here, a game over there. Or I could read a comic book on my iPad or read a book on my iPad. Or I could read that other comic book on my iPad. By the time I actually nestle into that bed and decide what the heck I'm going to do, I have established 14 different possibilities that I could all do from the comfort of my stupid pillow.
Yeah.
That didn't exist when I was a kid.
Right.
Period. There's nothing like this. You were just lucky if you caught part of Johnny Carson when our parents were in their heyday. And then you'd go to bed and that was it. I mean, there weren't all these options. Or you had a real book you had to pull out and find the stupid turned page for. And
you like, might get a paper cut.
It's just that we have these, it's weird. It's like as the stresses have grown, the escape valves have grown.
Or is it the other way around?
I don't know. I find it fascinating because I love popular culture. I love all the things I've been talking about. Love them. But even I have to admit, and I think anybody who's sort of sane and has eyeballs can see, there is just so much more now than right. there ever been. Now, what that means ultimately, I don't know. I guess that's what we talk about today a little
right.
bit.
Well, but, and I don't know what it means collectively, but I'm going to talk about what happens to us individually. So I need a disclaimer really quick that I am not a neuroscientist,
all right.
but I want to be one and I want to play one on TV. And I love everything about it. And I recently went to a training on stress reactivity and addiction. So I'm going to talk a lot about stuff that I learned from that. It was really phenomenal. Mm. You know, when you go to like a thing and you're like, okay, I had like other work to do while I was there because I figured it'd be boring.
Yeah.
And I had to go to this thing. I took more notes than I did all of college combined. It was so great. Anyway.
How do you know about these things?
You get little postcards.
Someone will tell you.
Okay. It says, because we have to do, you know, so many hours of continuing education stuff.
Right, right.
So I'm always trying to pick the nerdiest thing I can find.
Wait, that's interesting. You guys, as a master's degree holder in your field, you are still required?
Yeah.
You have to show that?
You have to go 40 hours of training every 2 years.
I have no idea.
Yeah.
So that just keeps you fresh.
You don't want us taking
the
book we just learned. No.
Well, that's I don't think people think about that. I think do lawyers and people like this have to do this?
Yeah.
Does it brush up on this crap?
Oh yeah.
How about doctors? They do the same thing.
Yeah.
I think my dentist hasn't been doing his.
I think you haven't hung out with enough professionals because
maybe
they all do it and it's kind of a pain in the behind. No, it's great. Actually, I
think that's
really
the way it should be. It sounds good.
Right. It's good. So one of the things she was talking about, I'm going to drop her name because she's awesome. Lisa Ellis. She's at Westminster, which is a school here.
Mm-hmm.
With
very
a beautiful,
school.
Beautiful campus. Yeah, wow.
It's very nice.
I got lost and I'm walking around and there's birds singing.
It's gorgeous.
And I'm like, where
and you pay
I?
For it. I'm telling you.
Yeah, no kidding. It's awesome.
So much
anyway,
money.
She talks about epigenetics, which is, you know, genetics. We all have our basic eighth grade biology model right in our heads.
Yep. Yep.
Epigenetics is the expression or silencing of certain genes based on
Epigenetics.
All right. EPI.
Epigenetics.
Yeah. Okay. Epigenetics.
Epigenetics.
Blaine. Okay. So basically, so all of us have so many genes or whatever, right? And we get the stuff from mom and the stuff from dad. And then certain things express themselves and certain things never express themselves, right? So you can take someone's genetic material, look at certain genes and see, oh, this is expressed or not. What we're finding is that certain genes are being turned on or off or, you know, kept silent based on some environmental factors. They can be based on drugs. They can be based on nutrients or nutrient deficiencies. It just makes your genetic material a little more vulnerable to doing things it might not otherwise do. Right.
All right. Okay.
So that whole nature versus nurture fight we love to have,
mm-hmm.
It's all of the above. So your nature may come, you know, you may come with a certain code, but nurture and your experience in life can sort of activate certain genes, right?
Logically, the idea that those were separate never made sense to me anyway.
Right.
Like the whole argument that nurture is how a guy turns out versus nature's how a guy turns out.
Right.
Always landed on me like, how about a whole bunch of both columns, really?
Right, right. Well, and so, you know, twin studies gives us, they give us a lot of ideas here because you have, you know, the same genes
yeah.
for the most part. And then you have, you know, if you look at the genome of a three-year-old twins and you can see the genes that are expressed in both of those twins, they're very similar. But you take them as 56-year-olds and look at their genome, you're going to see major differences in what's expressed and not. Even though they may still look exactly the same
even
or even
if they hang
seem
out a lot
the same.
And,
yeah, yeah, raised by the same family.
Yeah.
So we love to blame parents for everything. And this is not a show about blaming parents, okay?
Everyone. I've noticed as they get older, twins get older.
They get uglier?
One of them starts, because the one you know the most or maybe hang out or see the most,
mm-hmm.
the other one starts to look a little uncanny valley. Like they start to look like a weird, twisted version of the other one. Because there are differences and because yeah. you're
staring
pattern
at that
recognition.
Face.
Yes, you're not looking at that face all the time.
Right.
Those differences jump out at you almost like, is he wearing a mask? Is that like that weird feeling of like not distrust, but like this is something's not right here?
Yeah.
I get that all the time with
or
twins.
Take like just sun damage. One has more sun damage on his face than the other and it's going to wrinkle sooner or have a weird.
Yeah. Or one eats more than the other one.
Yeah.
Or, yeah.
Deposits or whatever.
Okay. More weight. This guy lifts more. You know.
So here's kind of the most important thing that makes this relevant to this conversation is that stress can make epigenetics a thing. So the more stress we're experiencing, the more it may reveal, express, or silence certain genes.
Okay.
Which, so you just set the stage for, we have more stress, but granted, you know, you're 40 something. And if we sat every 40 something person down in history and said, tell me about your stress level, is it just something that's going to come with this age, which is staring down retirement, raising kids, you know, maybe
it's all relative anyway, right?
Right. Like but the thing stressed. We're hearing is that younger people expressing stress in higher and higher, you know, volume, basically
at younger ages,
young kids. Yeah. I remember Lexi is our niece and not a couple years ago, she was 13 at the time. She's like, wow, time is just going so fast.
I never said that when I was 13.
I know, right?
I complain to the opposite constantly.
Yeah, like, can we please hurry up with this day that's a nightmare? Yeah. So she just feels like time is flying by.
That's funny.
Which stress does that sort of thing, which is, you know, maybe the day feels long, but the weeks fly by when you have more stress than
when
you're relaxed.
And the months and years are just poof.
Yeah.
Just gone.
Yeah. So you're going to see sort of across the board, I think because technology lets us do so much more in the same amount of time. I think we sleep less. I think there's a lot of things there. But, you know, younger people feel it. Kids feel it. You know, whatever.
Yeah.
Okay. So stress can be part of this thing that is interesting. And here's this idea that just freaked me out to the core that I just want to share. It's called the grandmother effect.
Okay.
So if I could draw you a picture, I would do show you the, you know, this dissection of a pregnant woman that shows all her organs and there's the baby in the womb.
Right.
And then you'd circle the baby and there's the baby and the baby has, so this, the woman is your grandmother.
Right.
And then the baby in the womb is your mother.
Okay.
And she has all her eggs she'll ever have already. So we can circle the little legs and there's Scott in the womb. So what happens to your grandmother is happening to you.
Okay.
So the toxins, the stress, the whatever, right? So, you know, this genetic passing on is not just, hey, here's this gene I have. It's also some of this expression. At least that's what they're looking at. So.
Okay.
There's a lot of study out there. Anyway, okay. So let's talk about some basic brain stuff.
Okay.
We all have the basic brain. Yeah, the basic brain. So we all have certain parts of our brain and the amygdala is kind of probably your favorite.
Wait, why? What does it happen?
That's the threat detection center.
Oh, is it my favorite?
Yeah. Well, it just gets used a lot with you.
People at home, I have, we have in my family specifically a labeling problem where everyone has a label and mine is often this. So continue. It's fine.
Okay. Yours is amygdala friendly.
Uh-huh.
So the amygdala is where, I mean, thank goodness for it or we'd all be dead, right?
Right. You got to have it. If there's a giant saber-toothed tiger over your shoulder,
totally.
You need it.
Right. So it says, it, you know, sounds the alarm, then the hypothalamus gets activated, all your hormones start doing their thing and eventually go to the pituitary gland and the adrenal glands and then you get all the hormones and neurotransmitters, all that stuff that says run, you know, and then cortisol is released, which basically helps burn sugar or glucose for energy, right? Right. That's the run from the tiger stuff.
Okay.
Fight or flight. Yeah.
Fight or flight.
And I like to add freeze. Because freeze is one too.
Is it?
Fight,
like
flight,
deer in the headlights.
Total deer in the headlights.
Is that what that is?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
So then what happens is you get away from the tiger, you climb up a tree, you're safe or whatever.
Yeah.
Then what happens is the cortisol gets released. It goes through your body, releases the glucose in your cells, and you can bust a move, right? Then when you stop and calm down, the threat is gone. The amygdala is like, all right, we're good. And then the cortisol travels its way right back up to the brain.
Yeah.
And there's these receptors that sort of grab onto it, you know? And it tells your, it's a negative feedback loop. It tells your brain, it's all good. Calm down. And then you get other chemicals that sort of calm you down. It's fine. You're fine. Problem is,
that's the system,
yeah,
as intended, as normal.
That is intended, okay. Yes. And what we have now is no shutting off. So we're flooding our systems with cortisol. If we're chronically stressed, we flood that system, and that feedback loop starts to get a little damaged.
For the people that still works for, though, they seem like aliens to me.
Yeah, and they are, because they're rare anymore.
Because you'll see them dealing with something as terrible as you just dealt with, and they'll just, you know, they can let it go, or it never came in the first place because they just were chill through the whole thing. I don't even know who those people are anymore.
Yeah.
Like, who is that?
Well, it's me. Nice to meet you. This is where our epigenetics vary, because I don't.
But I would argue you're kind of high strung, but not in a, I don't mean that in a negative way, but you're not like someone who's just kind of chill, letting stuff happen and not worrying about anything. Like, if you're in a, you do the thing I do all the time, which is you get in a situation where there's nobody's taking any leadership, so you just freaking take it.
Yeah.
That is not too far a stone's throw from where I take it, maybe too far, which is I tend to.
You internalize the story,
yes,
of, oh gosh, I got to do this. No one else is doing it. And,
yeah.
Why and I, is that? What if I do it wrong?
Why aren't they doing it? And if blah, I do blah, it wrong, blah. What would they say? And how come that guy over there is looking at me funny? And yeah.
I go, all right, let's get it done.
Yeah. It's there's.
So I don't have a, the story stress. I think I have, I understand what you're saying. It's not like I'm laying around like, hey, everyone, it's cool.
Yeah.
But when it's done, it's done.
Yeah.
And in fact, they have some really interesting studies they've been looking at where they'll show, you know, subliminal messages. They're not messages, but like images.
They'll flash something up.
Yeah, flash it up on the screen. So what they do is there's a little dot in the middle of the screen.
Yeah.
I'm drawing this with my hand, everyone. Yeah. Yeah. And it's in the middle of the screen. And there's two images on either side of the dot that will flash, and it's subconscious. You will not actually, your mind cannot process as fast as you can see it. But obviously your brain will process it.
Right.
And then after those images disappear, there will be a dot over one of those images. And what they found is there's kind of two kinds of folks. There's people who they are drawn towards a negative image. So the image would be a gun.
Okay.
And then the other image would be a spoon.
Okay.
And so where your mind is trained to go is where you'll see the dot, right? So does that make sense?
But who wouldn't be more drawn to the gun than the spoon anyway?
Me.
Is it just, really?
So let me tell you what happened. So they did this test for us, and I'm sitting next to this woman, and, you know, it flashes up on the screen, and I get the dot right every time, and she's getting it wrong every time. And I'm like, why are we getting this opposite, you know?
And you're just sitting right next to
her. Yeah, and then she shows us the image, and I go, oh my gosh, there's an image of a gun? And she goes, oh, that's the only thing I saw. So you have these pre-amygdala moments, right? Where you're almost more susceptible. You should be like the guards outside the village of your tribe to survive, because you are on some sub threshold aware of danger.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And in my case, and so she's doing this whole thing, and I felt so validated for the first time in my life about this, because she described these people who literally turn away from negative images. And you know me, I've never seen images from 9/11. I've never seen the big old wave. What's it called? Tsunami.
Tsunami.
Any of those images?
The big old wave.
The stuff in Philippines recently.
Yeah.
I don't see visual images of devastation. There are people who seek it out. So
what you're saying is when you, this is telling, because it's not that you didn't see, like that day there was news and there was stuff and you were seeing things. You saw things.
But I avoided them.
But you avoided them. Yeah. You didn't seek them out. If you saw anything, it would be this brief blip or whatever. But you would kind of actively not engage.
Yeah.
I have a thing where I cannot stand it if I don't know exactly what happened there.
Right. Right. Which includes the visual information. For me,
is that why I crave documentaries the way I do?
Probably. And there's a reason I crave radio. Because I get to pick the image in my head.
That's interesting. But I crave that too. It's weird though. But I know what you're saying, and I would have to cop to this. There's definitely a tendency for me to go, like, here's one for you. This was a while ago now, but there's that famous trial in South Africa with that athlete dude.
Yeah, yeah.
Who supposedly killed his girlfriend.
Pistoria. Yeah.
And they were presenting evidence. And they're filming, this whole thing's being broadcast, except you can't see him. The whole agreement was the cameras would never be trained on him. There are no actual cameramen. They're all stationary cameras.
Yeah.
And it can see lawyers and judges' face and crowd faces in the area there, but they can't ever see the dude or anyone up there testifying.
Okay.
And they accidentally, while they're flipping through some pictures on the overhead, flipped through one of the pictures, and one of the pictures was a very graphic image of her body after the murder.
Wow.
Sort of just bloody and laying there. And they don't actually show this in the video clip, but the video clip that I was drawn to was, it's very boring kind of courtroom stuff. And what are we seeing here? Well, that's the where the blood spatter. It was very mathematical and stuff. But supposedly at some point, when they accidentally flashed through this photo they weren't supposed to show, the suspect sees it, or the defendant sees it, and breaks down in like horrible tears and ends up just like vomiting everywhere and like has this horrible visceral reaction to what he saw. And you don't even see this in the video, nor do I really want to see something like that, like a visual of that.
Yeah.
But I just had to see the video where supposedly this guy off camera is having this complete breakdown. I couldn't help it. Right. It's like, I got to see this.
Yeah.
I have to see if my head has this worse than it really was, or is this worse than I think it is.
Right.
Overwhelmingly, I had to know.
Right.
You would have been like, eh.
That would be the last thing I would seek out.
That's really interesting.
And then the evidence of the... So then they can... The crazy thing is they could take our alleles, our genetic code, and see what has been expressed or not. And you and I would have different expressions of certain alleles.
Sure.
They call them the... Oh, shoot. What do they call them? Anyway, there's a couple different ones.
By the way, folks, this is why Wendy cannot draw stick figures and I can draw.
Because literally, I have no imagination.
Well, you have some.
No, I don't.
If you're listening
to
the radio.
No visual imagination.
And when you're listening to the radio, you have to kind of construct things.
Right.
So you have some, but it's probably all, it's all real straightforward and basic.
Right. Well, take Harry Potter, right? You listened to the books or you read it. And you visualize how everyone's supposed to look, and then you watch the movie and you're disappointed. And then eventually it replaces your imagination.
Yeah.
Because now I can't think of Hagrid as anything but the actor, right?
Yeah.
So it's not that I don't have an imagination. It's that my imagination is not scary. It doesn't go to scary places, but I've also not consumed a lot of that. So chicken and the egg, I don't know. But the reality is we have very different responses. So if there is an accident on the freeway, what does everyone do? They stare.
They rubberneck,
They rubberneck. And I find myself like wanting to rubberneck, and it's like, there's something to me that doesn't do it. It's bizarre.
That is a little bizarre. Cause I have the same compulsion to not, I don't want to.
Right. But you can't.
I'll go past an accident and go, I really don't want to. And then there are times where it's like, I have to see this anyway, cause it's right in the view of my periphery and I'm going to go past it and see it anyway. And then I don't see anything that of significance. Just like, oh, there's a gurney and maybe the dude or whatever walking around, but I don't see any carnage or blood or gore or anything.
Yeah.
But I made it all up in my head anyway. Almost worse.
Right.
Because by the time I'm on the other side of the freeway, I'm like, I'll bet that guy was in like three pieces, or I'll bet it was like that one wreck I heard about, or that time I saw that driver's ed video in high school. It was probably as bad as that or whatever.
Oh my gosh. The prom video.
Yeah. That stuff is terrible.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah. Lucky
why
you.
Then?
Lucky you.
Okay. Let's say this is let's say this was so detrimental to me that I do that and you don't.
Okay.
Not that you don't, meaning that I do it and it's a problem for me. Can people be trained out of that kind of response / thinking / this need to like see if the dude's getting pried out of the wreckage or not? Like,
well,
and what is that?
Let me define a little bit. It's called negative attentional bias.
All right.
That means you just subliminally
sub-threshold
attention system. Right. Your executive functioning, all of your, you know, brain stuff together means you just kind of look at it. So there is a gene called the BDNF, the brain-deprived neurotrophic factor, that has two alleles. They're called the VAL and the MET. And if you have the MET allele, you're going to be like you. If you don't, you're going to be like me. It's the VAL means you're
not anxious. Why'd you not get it if we're the same?
I don't know.
We're both birthed from those same loins.
I know, but it's also maybe expression of that allele. I don't know exactly. And I they're still looking at it.
Can gender play a role in that?
Potentially, but look at mom. Hey, mom. Anyway, so they're they're looking at a lot of stuff like that. They're also finding that, you know, kind of how your serotonin stuff works. You know, how you reuptake it. There's alleles, there's a short and a long one, and people have different ones. And so there really is a genetic component to your ability to manage this or not. However, I don't think we make it better by staring at car accidents all day.
This is something I even, the most extreme cases on either side of this thing could agree on, I think, is that if you want to stop reinforcing or growing your negative, whatever you called it, BSDM, whatever, whatever it was.
Just BS.
We'll call it BS.
BND, whatever.
Then you aren't going to help that if you are reinforcing it all the time.
Right. Right. So let's talk about this for a second. So the hippocampus is that part of your brain that learns and has memory.
So the hippos go to college. The hippocampus.
It's the campus. And that is, it's very plastic.
Yeah.
You can recreate, kill it, grow it back. I mean, this is the most malleable part of our brains.
Could I take it out and it would just be gone?
No. You really need it.
Okay.
And essentially, there's a memory in there. It marinates is the right word. And then it moves to long-term storage, right? Yeah. Uh-huh. It's always changing. It's you can RAM. Actually grow. It's RAM. It's RAM. And you can always grow cells there and whatnot. Okay. So what we found is that cortisol, when it gets released because you're stressed, strengthens the power of memories. So take anything visual you've seen that's kind of traumatizing. This will resonate with
guy
people.
Guy getting pulled out of the river. And by the way, I think this may have a lot to do with why I feel this way about a lot of things. Dude got dead body, pulled out of the river, 1984. We're just kids. You're way younger than me.
Yeah, and I'm avoiding looking. I remember this.
You're not
this.
Even going there. Right, but I'm up there with some friends looking down the road, and I see them pull a naked 30-something-year-old man out of the, which to me seemed like a really old person.
Yeah, like a grandpa at
34
that point.
Years is nothing. Mm-hmm. It's tragic now that you think about it, because he was so young. But they pull this guy out of this overflowing river. We had horrible flooding that year. And pulled him out, laid him on a tarp, and then covered him. And I remember very specifically going, this is absolutely, totally new for my ability to sense something. Like I'd never seen a dead body or any the whole implication of what I was seeing. My brain had never had to deal with it before. But I kind of thought, no big deal. I go home, chilling out, do whatever I do. Wake up in the middle of the night with the most horrible night terrors. I yacked all over the couch. Total shock. I was in shock. And
delayed.
And mom came and found me, and I just was a mess. And I was a mess for a while. And then, you know, you kind of move past it. Now it's a story I tell. But but I do feel like it's this weird pivotal moment of, like, not trauma so much. It was maybe that's what it is ultimately. But the idea is that you see the face of what it could be, and now you kind of can't look away because it just seems such like bright light.
And you can't get your innocence back.
Yeah, you can't. I can't tell what it was like before that to know what it wasn't like to see a dead body pulled from a river.
Right.
And it's in a weird way, it's like that's still more haunting to me than any visualization of death I've seen in any movie or TV show. Those are all stupid compared to
real. Right. Well, the other thing that's interesting is the amygdala does not go to sleep when you go to sleep. Mm. It's active in your sleep, which is why we have nightmares, which is why we, you know, threat detection in our sleep. There's a Radiolab about sleep that is so interesting. How we're literally the last mammal on the planet. The only mammal, not the last, the only mammal who climbs into a warm, comfy bed and closes both eyes.
Yeah.
And we didn't always do that.
Yeah.
We had to sleep with one eye open for many years, right? many, 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 you know, iterations of human beings. And right. then suddenly we get to just go to sleep with both eyes shut in this nice, safe place. Well, the amygdala hasn't caught up. It will wake you up. It will haunt you. It'll give you dreams. It'll whatever. So this is, and the amygdala is taking its stress from the day or what it, yeah. you know, it's processing. And then it jacks it up with weird characters and makes this crazy thing, right?
I dream like a crazy person.
Right. So you can see how like cyclically stress can.
But maybe this is just you doing, maybe it's just you doing what you did that makes the difference. So in other words, how is it so much more genetics than it was just you making a decision when you were, I guess I was 13 or something when this happened. And I saw this and you'd have been 6.
Yeah.
You actively, and you remember this, you actively avoided seeing anything to do with it. So you made this decision. I don't want to see it. I made this decision. I'm going to look.
I mean, I would have been 9.
9, okay. I got the math wrong.
And I...
So I was 14,
no,
I guess.
It was earlier than that.
It was 84. We moved when 83.
Okay. So I was...
So no. we had just moved to... Well, maybe not
no.
just.
No. So I was like 5. It was 80. It had to be 80.
No, 83 is the big... I'm sure that was the big thing.
82. Look at us. Shut up, everyone.
Whatever.
Okay, so anyway.
The point is, you made this decision to not look. I made this decision or this mistake to look. And maybe because you just kept doing that.
Yeah.
And just every time it came up, it was like a game for you to go, I'm not going to look.
But you're acting as if a decision was actually made in a six-year-old's mind of like, I will not look at images that are scarring.
And you're saying no.
And the genes are saying no. The genes are saying, but my guess is, and again, I'm not a neuroscientist, people, is that... the epigenetic thing is the factor that a gene gets expressed because of exposure,
yeah.
potentially, and my lack of exposure over and over and over. But on some level, I just have always avoided it.
Yeah.
I've often felt like I'm kind of a weirdo. Everyone else is like, oh, remember 9/11? I'm like, not really. and really, I didn't have a TV. And so there are people who watch bodies.
Oh, this is true. This is really odd. You didn't have any of that stuff.
Yeah. And so then there's also, you know, I went to a friend's house after work and she had not left the couch all day and just watched over and over and was sobbing. And I averted my eyes from the TV the whole time.
Oh, I kind of did some of that too. Not averting the other way.
You were her. I get
obsessed.
It. So I
bawled like a child the year after for the anniversary.
Right.
Where they were just talking about these people who had died and stuff. And I cried like a little kid.
Right.
And this was, you know, I was 32 or something. 31, 32. And I just bawled.
I might be a robot.
You might be a freaking robot. But okay.
But this is how this works out.
It's a balance
as a therapist.
Thing, right? It's a balance thing. Because at some point you are, if you're too look the other way. And not fill your head with any of the negative imagery or any of the negative whatever or anything you perceive as negative. Don't you, when something does happen under your purview with a child or something else, doesn't it kick into where it's like, well, now you can't necessarily deal with it as well because normally this is the thing you'd turn your head and walk away from.
Right.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, but...
I'm not saying you're doing that. No, I'm saying...
But
isn't
not
that
in real... The thing about this is, for me, it's not in real life. I mean, look at what I do. I sit across from somebody and I listen to the most horrific thing that's ever happened to them.
Yeah.
I work with the Rape Recovery Center. I work with homeless kids. This is not that I don't want to see real problems. It's that I don't want to see traumatic images. Yeah. Is that and to me, that's the car accident. That's pulling a dead body out of the river. That's, you know, whatever. But then the question is, did I choose that?
Right. Nah, and seeing a kid in tattered clothes at a homeless shelter isn't so much a traumatic image as it is a call to action, right? So you'll see that and go, I can help that kid right now.
Right. Whereas if I watch the tsunami devastation, what am I going to do about
that? You're helpless.
There's
nothing you can do.
And maybe I just avoid helplessness. That might be it. Because the other thing...
That's what I'm driving at.
The other thing that comes down to is I am a freaky optimist.
Yeah.
So when I sit with somebody who is scarred like you wouldn't believe... I just like, oh, I see your future self and it's pretty awesome. And I'm it's real. I'm not saying that. I really feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
When I've seen like super, super crazy, I have thought maybe once in 15 years, I don't know if I can help them.
Yeah.
That was a guy who tried to kill his neighbor with a hacksaw.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Anyway.
A hacksaw. Wait, what is that?
You know, like a.
Oh, like one with the one that's like shaped like a. A long U.
And yeah, yeah.
Like,
and you need two people
awful.
Or whatever.
Yeah,
and he went over to his neighbors.
Cut pipes with it?
Yeah. Well, this is terrible, but I kind of joke when I do confidentiality. I say, so if you're going to kill yourself or someone else, don't tell me because, you know, that's, I'd have to tell someone else. That's how confidentiality works. And this guy goes, oh, I tried to kill my neighbor with a hacksaw.
Does that count?
And I was like, so then I have, where's the door?
Yeah.
And then I'm like, I'm bigger than you. You're kind of a shorty. And where are my weapons? You know, like I get into the, whoa, I'm ready.
Yeah.
But I'm smiling and whatever. But so it's not that I have a broken system. My amygdala works. It's just I'm not burning it out, right?
But could you be, since they're expanding, this is a controversial thing I'm about to say. So at home, just chill for a minute. But I'm just going to say this. They're expanding, especially this year. You hear it talked about a lot. The definition of and the range of autism classes, classes of autism.
Yeah.
And they're moving away from like specific things like Asperger's and calling it a new classification because it's really not fair to give it its own thing while there's 50 others that are just right around the border of it that are kind of the same. But then there's like rings in a tree trunk just keeps going. Do you think that either the person who is obsessed with the negative imagery or the person who avoids it like you do, does that land somewhere on this? Because it seems like the people who probably have it the best, I don't know if this is true or not, but it seems like the people maybe have this figured out, like always, seem to have got some balance of understanding what the real impact of the thing was, even if it involved some negative imagery, but then they were able to take that stuff and process it in a way that's a little more logical and straightforward and not and less about helplessness and stressing themselves out or I could have done something or whatever. Is it possible that is it possible that either extreme lands somewhere in a this is really hard to explain. Not in an area of disability, but it's a little weird that you've never seen any of that 9/11 stuff. Mm-hmm. By the overall standard, which is not everybody is obsessed with the negativity of it.
Yeah, but on some gradation, sure.
Some gradation, somebody's like, yeah, I saw it. It was awful. And that just makes me want to live my life to the best every day and do whatever I can. That there's a real positive dude. Another guy, it's like, this makes me lose all hate, hope, and humanity. If that thing could happen, then what could happen right now? And they're on this way other end of the spectrum.
Yeah.
I don't know what I'm getting at.
You're getting at, is our brain structure, is our expressing genes or not expressing genes, is all of that matter?
Right.
And the answer is yes, it matters, but we're in such a new stage of this. I mean, studies from the 1990s, might as well be the 1800s, the 200s. It's so ancient. Mm. That's as ancient as we get with neuroscience. Mm. 90s.
That seems wrong.
Crazy.
I mean, part not wrong that you're wrong, but wrong.
The
like
imaging, the imaging technology, and you know, some of the earliest studies are fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, they're obviously with rats and lots of other things, but they found some just crazy stuff. One being high stress. You know, babies are actually protected from cortisol through the placenta, right?
Oh.
So a mom can be really stressed out, and in theory,
cortisol is a stressful stuff.
Yeah, is it's not passing through. So mom stress is not impacting baby. But what they're finding out more recently is that some of it's starting to get through, and chronic stress like poverty. Poverty kills people, by the way. Anyway,
that is a whole show.
Yeah, anyway, but you know, it can start to get through. So I mean, I think there's just lots of amazing stuff coming out, but no one knows anything definitively. So they cannot take someone with autism. And yes, you're right. It's very controversial.
Right.
And figure this all out quite yet. But I think what they are finding is that even take these two alleles, you and I have different expressions of them. Did we do that by making behavioral choices that have ended in that expression or not? The answer is probably, but they can't definitively prove that. But they do know that subliminally, I'm in that category that my attention does not go toward it. You have negative attentional bias. You are going to go, you're going to see the gun.
I want to see the zombie movie. You don't.
Right.
Yeah.
Have I even seen one zombie movie?
You know who's, I have good news for you.
Okay, good.
Carter appears to have your take on this gene.
Excellent.
Because she is completely non-interested in any of that. She doesn't go toward the light at all when it comes to negative anything. Even if it's just simply, that girl, I wish I was in that social group at school. And if I just was nice to that girl who's mean to me, maybe she'll let me in. She's no interest. None. Because to her, that's negative. That's all negative. She's like, why would I do that?
So I'm going to avoid it.
And she doesn't want to see a zombie movie. She doesn't want anything to do with any kind of negative imagery. It needs to all, it's not like her whole life has to be just happy, smiley all the time. It's just she's not drawn to it. Right. And I feel like she is that, that feels like a natural inclination of her since day one to just choose that side.
Right.
Now she might accidentally, she was at a friend's house once. They turned on, I think it was even like a comedy. Oh, Zombie Land, which is a mostly a comedy. Yeah. It's like a dark comedy that's involves zombies, but it's not meant to be dramatic. It's supposed to be funny.
Yeah.
I haven't actually seen it, but she saw it, tiny piece of it over at her friend's house and just won't look at zombies ever. Not because it traumatized her. She doesn't want to see him. Yeah. She's like, I didn't want to see him then. I don't want to see him now. Oh, but Carter, there's these great, cool ideas being expressed, and it's about society, and it's me and men. She doesn't, whatever.
She's like, whatever.
She blows it off. It's very
whatever
you.
Whatever, zombie lover.
It's very you. So,
well, okay. You know. And then my son has your gene.
Yeah, he sure does.
Oh, we're real happy about that. So let me give people some hope here, because if you are predisposed to look at these things, you're genetically, you know, you're not going to get disability for this. Don't try to file for that. Like, hey, I have a negativity, attention bias, and I'm scared all the time. But you can actually train your attention, because it is an attention issue. So subliminally, I don't know if you can get to that real easily, but you can create some effortful control over what you focus on, right? So what is Carter doing? Not focusing on zombies. What are you doing? Focusing on car wrecks and zombies.
Right? Well, sort of.
But I basically mean, what it
if
is.
If you got an email and I got an email and it said, hey, Wendy and Scott, comes from a trusted source.
Yeah.
Someone we both know. Another sibling or whatever. And it says, click this link. It's a video of a dude setting himself on fire and jumping out of a 30-story window to his death.
Oh, hell. I would never open that.
You would never go near it. No. I would go, really? On fire? Who would do that? Why would you do that? I start asking a billion questions about why, where are you in your life that you have set yourself on fire and jumped out of a window?
Right.
Why would you do that to yourself and therefore affect all the people who actually cared about you?
I have all those same questions. Like,
I'm not going, oh, yeah, dude.
Guy, no, I know. I have those same questions. I just don't want to see it.
Yeah, see, that's a weird thing.
So tell me this. This is so off subject, but awesome. So there's a restaurant in Salt Lake called Cedars of Lebanon. And
it's good.
They have belly dancers.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't know that.
On Friday and Saturday night.
Food's really good.
Food is great. And the belly dancers Friday and Saturday night. And we went, and I really struggle. I can't look at her. And she's all next to me. And anyway.
Because they go around table to table.
Yeah. And so we were some friends. And I was like, all right, people, what is the amount of money it would take for you to do this? And I said this, and I'm dead serious. And no one could believe me. But I'm like, not for $1 million.
And you mean that.
I mean it. And
for you to belly dance.
And Adam's like, I'd do it for 50.
What I would do.
And I'm like, there's no way. So I'm weird in my own right. I mean, $1 million is not enough for me to belly dance for an hour.
Right. I would do it.
But it's not.
I would do it all night for
$1 million. I'd have to be so high. There's no way I couldn't do it. So here's where this actually makes sense. So our executive functioning, that prefrontal cortex part of our brain, uses some of these same genes that are so crucial in managing our cortisol levels, managing how the amygdala works, that reuptake system that calms us down. Mm-hmm. All of that is part of this network, right? Which is where our focus is. And everyone can improve their prefrontal cortex by changing what they put the spotlight on. So our attention is like a spotlight, right? It kind of moves around.
Yeah.
And you can train your brain. So this is, we always talk about mindful meditation. That is one of the major benefits from that.
Is that why I struggle with that so much? Because it's just impossible for me to have my mind stay in one place. And I know that the practice is supposed to be bring it back. You feel it wandering. Don't worry. It's cool. It happens all the time. Just bring it back. Bring it back. Bring it back.
Right.
I'm exposing myself here a little bit, but I feel like when I go for a real hardcore session of that because I need it or whatever, sometimes one of the techniques is just to count your breaths. You know, count the long, deep breaths you're taking. One. Two, and I lose it at two.
Yeah, zombie apocalypse.
Where I should be thinking of three, I'm thinking about not necessarily negative things, just a billion other things.
Yeah.
I can't rope it in.
Yeah.
It's like, no. Remember, we're counting breaths. It's really the simplest thing you can do. When you were three, you could count. You can do it now. So bring it back and count the breaths again. So I'll start over really hard this time. Focused. I get to like five. And then there's something
comes in
shiny in my brain. And I go, what's that? And then I follow it somewhere and I go, no, wait, you're supposed to be back here.
Yeah.
It's hard, man.
And the key is to not judge yourself for not doing it right.
Right.
And just bring
That's
it back.
Hard too.
And here's the thing. It's like any kind of training. You just get better at it as you go along. Mm. That's not the goal, of course, because it's non-judgmental. But in the end, you are basically training your mind to focus longer on one thing. And think of what we're training ourselves to do every day just with our smartphones.
Yeah.
So you're really compensating for an opposite kind of training. And the thing is if you can't ever feel calm.
Yeah.
And this training really can help sort of articulate some of the stuff that you need prefrontally. If you can't ever feel that way, eventually you kind of get to that burned out stage. There's a lot of people walking around like zombies. Maybe that's why we like zombies so much.
Well, but that's supposed to be the metaphor.
Right. Yeah. And the rat race creates that and whatever, right?
It's supposed to be the George Romero, when that all started with his movies, that was supposed to kind of be the idea. It was a reflection of society becoming zombies to markets and to... I mean, it was more that then than now, but today is even easier to make the comparison because there's all these things that that have dominion over us.
Right. When you watch someone walking and texting, you can see a zombie. There likeness with their posture. Mm-hmm. That's kind of freaky. Anyway, so you can train your brain to this. Let me speak about teenagers for a second.
Teenagers,
I
like those.
We all love teenagers.
Sure.
And this is actually why this matters. For whatever reason, you should have more depression or anxiety than you do because of genetic maybe factors. But for whatever reason, it didn't quite solidify. But with teenagers, their amygdala activity is heightened. Awesome, right?
Mm, yeah.
So they're a little more susceptible to the scary. And then their prefrontal cortex maturation is delayed. And what we are finding is it is delayed longer and longer. See 30-year-old in your basement.
See what you're saying.
Right. So the delay in
we're not discovering that it has always been longer.
No.
It's that it's going longer.
No. And there are cultures, and in fact, I raised this question with the neuroscientist. I said, there are cultures where adolescence almost doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And it's because they are modeled adult responsibility and behavior very early. So there is no like, go to spring break and enjoy your
Well, here we, whatever. I mean, you could argue before.
Industrial
this
revolution.
This is not a popular thing to talk about, but when kids had a very different role. As soon as they could lift, they were out on the farm,
right?
And they were doing adult things, and there weren't child labor laws, there weren't any of these things.
Right.
So obviously there's negative things that happened there, but they were more quickly ushered into adulthood,
right?
And they all died at 30.
So they needed to hurry.
Yeah, they needed to hurry
and
up.
And the truth is their brains wired around those experiences just like leisure and way too much free time and whatever wires around maybe that dynamic. So they're finding, though, interestingly, this delay in this maturation. So when your 29-year-old's like, I'm not moving out. This is the life.
Yeah.
Scan their brain. It's because it's not ready yet. And the only way to get it ready is kick them out. I'm just saying. Okay.
Does that do it?
Well, first of all, it's training. And the problem is societally is we wait too long to launch our kids or create enough boundaries so they launch on their own. Because sometimes we pay for them too long.
It's weird. I don't know what we're doing.
Support them too long.
I say we, Kim maybe, but the kids are ready to roll. Taylor couldn't wait to be 18, not because she couldn't wait to get away from us. She loves it here.
Yeah.
She couldn't wait to get out and be independent. Like she had goals and it seemed really cool to her and she couldn't wait to get there and do it. And she's working her butt off and doing really well. She may be, more stressed than I'd like her to be, but she was ready to go. And Carter constantly talks about it.
Right.
Dad, I can't wait to have my own apartment. I'm going to do this and this and this and this. I'm going to do all this stuff and I can't freaking wait. I'm not 18 quick enough. Oh, you want to leave us? No. They don't want to leave us, but they want to go do this thing. So I don't even, let's see how Nick turns out, but I don't feel that thing of like, oh man, we screwed up and they're going to.
Everyone just wait until Nick's older. It's all right. If you're thinking Scott's got it going on.
Nick's, Nick, I can't tell yet. I've never been able to tell with him.
I know. And
at all.
And not that it's, I think parenting, we think everything comes down to the parent, how they handle everything. Sometimes it's the kids. Sometimes
it's
whatever.
Yeah.
But there are messages like you move out when you're 18 or you're ushering in. Well, part of it is get a job, make your own money. You're giving them things as you go along. And if one more parent says, well, school is my kid's job, I'm going to punch him in the face because
that's terrible.
Real life is way more than school. And I understand they're busy, but part of it is we keep these kids so busy. Oh, we're not talking about this topic again. It always comes up. Okay, go back to teenagers.
Helicopter
look
parenting.
At me. I'm stopping myself.
All
okay.
Right, I like it.
But what happens is this delayed prefrontal cortex development and hyper amygdala, you know, teenage stuff, and then sort of, I'm going to say helicopter rescuing parenthood, okay. Combine into just more risk for depression and anxiety.
So what happens? Let me ask you this then. Let's say Carter gets out on her 18th birthday, like yeah. she plans, and she's super stoked, and she gets out there and she goes, ugh. This is not what I expected. The grass wasn't greener on the other side. Yeah. Man, I'm homesick. Dad, come pick me up, and I don't want to do this.
Well, that happened with Taylor a little bit.
It did with her school
yeah,
choice.
First one,
it
yeah.
was. And I struggled with it because yeah. when I got her on the phone, she called me. And for whatever reason, I'm the one she wants to talk to when it comes to this stuff. You know how that is. Different roles, different parents, whatever. Different kids. So she wanted to come home, and we had a long conversation, and my gut kept saying, make her stick this one out. Make her do it. But as we got further and further into the conversation, I perceived anyway that that wasn't really the issue. This isn't her not having the stick-to-itiveness to do something.
Right.
It was that she ended up somewhere that she thought she wanted to go to and based it purely on a lot of sort of other people's expectations of her or other people saying what's good. And her doing that, not really knowing for herself that it was good.
Yeah.
And so I ultimately said, fine, you don't have to go next semester. Let's get you home. But you're going to go back to school and you're going to do it quickly and you're going to get a job. You know, this isn't just come back.
Yeah.
And very quickly she came back, got the apartment, got roommates, did her thing, got enrolled in school again.
And you could tell.
Got a job.
It was just a better fit.
It was a better fit for her. And so I'm ultimately happy that I didn't make her stay. And yeah. I wasn't going to make her. She's 18. She should get to choose these things. But, yeah. you know, and these are all the big grand things we parents have to deal with when they come up. But what was my point with that? Where was I going with that?
I don't know. But that gives you, that's one of those kind of big moments.
Yeah, it was a big
it's
one.
A lot of little ones before that that kind of play a role.
Yeah.
But again, if you think of this just brain science wise, what happens, what you do, what you think about, what activities you get involved with creates brain matter. Like it's nuts how much that matters. So let me say something about the hippocampus. So we talked about that's where memory and learning and stuff is, and it's very plastic. It can change, you know, changeover is good, but let me just tell you. So this cortisol hormone that saves our lives and is a wonderful thing, right? Mm-hmm. But too much of it, is, you know, the right amount. Awesome. Too much of it means we start to lose plasticity. We start to lose the ability to create new neurons. This is where we ruminate. Okay. This is where, think about memory or context of memory. Like you talk about something, you remember something, you organize it in your brain, and then it goes off to long-term storage. How many times have you just thought the same crap over and over and stressed in that rumination? That's where that happens, right?
Yeah.
There's also some markings of when someone has depression, you can see it. There's anatomical evidence that they're in that part of the brain. It also stops creating new patterns. There's atrophy. I mean, we can look at all this, which is crazy.
Yeah.
So what we found out to keep it healthy is this gene that we talked about, but also, so this, you know, SSRIs,
yeah. the serotonin something reuptake inhibitors.
Yeah. Those actually can regenerate the hippocampus. That's why it works. It takes about 3 weeks.
Really?
And that's why it does that. And then also the other thing we know is that electroconvulsive
therapy.
Yeah.
Shock therapy.
Yeah. That also restarts and sort of regrows there. So here's where too much stress in our life long-term creates brain damage.
Okay.
And it can be rebuilt and rebooted. And there's, you know, thank goodness for that. Right. But it's difficult. And when we blow that fuse to that point, you know, sometimes drugs don't even work, right?
Yeah.
It takes a lot of healing and a lot of work. So it's a big deal.
Brains suck, man.
No, they don't. They're
amazing. No, because if you go hurt your elbow, we know what to do. And if it's so far gone that there's nothing you can do but just have pain the rest of your life or put in a metal thing or something, well, then you do.
Right.
With the brain, it's like...
It's insane.
It's all emotional stuff and like... You know, I always think if I'm going to get cancer, I want it to be in my crotch or something. I don't want it to be in my head, my brain, because it's so much more at stake.
Yeah, it's the most important thing you have.
It's everything.
I know.
I mean, everything else is tied to it. There's no... I had this sensation the other day. I was in the tub and water was coming out of the tub still, filling up, and I'm laying in, I'm just trying to chill, and water's hitting my toes. And for the first time ever, I felt the sensation of my toes through my brain. Now, that sounds strange, because that's only how we ever feel it. But we don't ever think of it that way. We think of it as when my toes are being hit by water, I can feel it there.
Yeah.
But I could feel it here, feeling it there. It's a strange thing to sense.
Yeah.
It didn't feel any different than it ever did.
Yeah,
but the notion popped in and I went, oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
Because it isn't really my toe.
Yeah.
It's this other thing who thinks something's happening down there for good or for not. If I had no foot, I could be getting a phantom pain down there for all I know. Like that stuff's real.
Yeah.
Like it was a really weird sensation. And then I was quickly thinking of something else and I forgot all about it, but just remembering it now. But it's an odd thing to know that your head is so in charge of every freaking thing you do.
Yeah.
So when you say there's real damage caused by stress, that makes me stress out a little bit because I think about all the needless stressing I do.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I know other people are like this. I'm making myself a bit of a victim today for everyone else's sake because I'm certainly not in the worst boat when it comes to this sort of thing. And I'm certainly not as good at this as I could be, but I have to think, and it sounds like from your client experience, there are huge amounts of people,
very common,
who struggle with this and in many cases don't even recognize it or don't even know what to say about it or are too embarrassed to say or anything or right. They work in an environment where weakness is not tolerated and that's perceived as weakness. And
right.
I mean, I can't imagine how complicated it gets for people.
Right. And you start to feel like I'm broken. Something's wrong with me.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, it's everybody, but no one's sort of speaking to it. I mean, there's a lot of books out recently about just our culture, the stress, you know, kind of the way we're managing time differently than we ever have.
Right.
And all sorts of things, you know, it's kind of on people's minds because people are stressing out quite a bit. Burnout's always been a thing. It's always, you know, existed, but we have the general pop. It used to be, you know, emergency workers, you know, people are working with people in trauma. I mean, doctors, whatever, where they are taxed quite a bit emotionally or physically all the time.
Yeah.
You know, like the average guy at a job that he, you know, shouldn't be that stressful was maybe not experiencing burnout like people are maybe more generally now. Partly because, you know, we're just all scattered. But there's another thing we got to talk about.
Okay.
Because this is crucial to all of this. So what I was just describing sort of generally was the stress reactivity system. That is how it all works for us. We got the cortisol and then the hormones and then the reuptake and the blah, blah, blah. And then you're like managing all of those things.
Yeah.
I would say the average person, probably everyone listening is thinking, yeah, I'm struggling with that because it's a pretty common thing. But this is the thing, the system that we don't necessarily always talk about that has a huge impact on that. And that is the reward system. So you and I did a show on pornography addiction. Yes, yeah. I said it, people.
A couple of weeks ago. Some controversy about that.
Yeah. And the controversy was that it's not diagnosable in the DSM-5.
As an addictive whatever.
Yeah. And nor is gambling or eating too much or shopping or all those other addictions that are real. Mm-hmm. They're just process addictions.
People are real sensitive about the porn one for some reason, though. Like, I know people who would not even argue with you if you said, oh, yeah, that person's got an eating addiction or that person has a gambling addiction. They wouldn't even bat an eye.
Yeah.
But the minute you tell them it's a porn addiction, then they get super defensive.
Yes. And I'm going to tell you a little bit of the brain science behind it. But
let's just lay it out and just say Wendy is a proponent of the theory that there is an addiction and right. can be an addiction.
Right.
Doesn't mean that everyone has it any right. more than anyone who drinks is an alcoholic.
Right.
I think it's just important to just lay it out there. We're not going to dance around the issue. Right. You think that there are people suffering from an addiction to pornographic images.
Right. And if you are hearing this and like, no, we're not, then just give up your porn for 30 days.
See how you do.
And also sit across from one and watch them detox in front of you because it really is the freakiest thing I've ever seen. I had a guy shaking. And I was like, I think we need to go to the hospital.
Wow.
Yeah. And let me tell you why.
That's
here
intense.
Is the brain science to prove this. And the DSM-5, if someone really wants to argue about this, just read the DSM-3 and see what we used to think about things.
What era would that have been? Just curious.
50s, 60s.
Same organizing body, very different view.
Yeah, very different people at this point. But, you know, and they're careful they go slow.
It's an evolving science.
Yeah, totally. And it's kind of a nightmare. I wouldn't want to be on that committee.
Right.
But the addictive, we call them process addictions or brain addictions. They use the exact same neural pathways, the exact reward system that drug use uses. It's no different. It's not going to have, oh, I have a gambling pathway and then I have a cocaine pathway. They are the same pathway. And also, ultimately, what it does is it's all about our dopamine, right?
Yeah.
And so it gets released and it's like, oh, this feels good. I should do this again. And that's, so what happens is it's similar to actually the cortisol, interestingly, it gets released. The dopamine gets released, it's, you know, and the receptors that catch it then calm you down. So what happens is if you have too much dopamine, then we have this regulating system. So, it, and you can't see me draw this, but basically like if this is the part that catches the dopamine, up here are these things called autoreceptors. They found them in just 2 years ago, by the way.
Oh, wow.
That's how new this crap is.
Wow.
And what happens is if you shoot too much dopamine, it floods up the sides of these nucleus accumbens is what they're called.
Yeah.
And the autoreceptors are like, way too much dopamine. So it downregulates. And that means it's not going to absorb all the dopamine.
Right.
It doesn't want as much. So it's going to produce less, which means
the
general crap in your
much.
Life doesn't feel good. So a walk in the park on a beautiful day no longer brings pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
You need a hit of whatever to get that pleasure. So you're jacking up your normal pleasure ability.
Yeah.
And so pornography is an example of, and let's talk about this. What actually pornography, why that's different than sex.
Sure.
Because pornography is the novelty. That's actually what creates so much of the dopamine. So something new and pleasurable, anything, right? I climb that mountain for the first time. I go see a movie that I love for the first time. You know, the newness factor is a dopamine, like, woohoo. And what pornography is.
And you get that with anything. Like if
anything,
you're.
Food. It could be anything.
Yeah. If you think about it, what is that otherwise? Like if you really are thinking about this stuff, to me, the first time you eat, I don't know, I'm trying to think of something I really like that blew me away when I first had it, but I can't think of anything. But let's say it was just this amazing Pop-Tart.
Wow.
It's a bad example. But you eat that and you go, oh, wow. That's amazing. I can't wait to have more of these. That was so cool. What is that? That's right. A chemical. That's a chemical in my head.
Absolutely. It's all in your head. Just like your toe thing.
It
all
has
in your
to
head.
Be in your head.
So, but the novelty part, some of us actually are a little more wired towards novelty. They're looking at genes that show that there are folks that the newness factor, it's kind of like the adrenaline junkies. You know, they're base jumping off of stuff.
Right.
So maybe more propensity for that. But the pornography thing is that novelty, now that you have the internet, is easily attainable. It's easy to get the new picture, the new video, the new, you know, and this is.
And the novelty is wearing off, you're saying?
So, no, it's just that access to new stuff is so big that
right.
You are getting more entranced in that stuff than you would otherwise if you had to always go to the store to get a thing.
Wear a fake mustache and a long coat.
Totally, right?
Yeah.
So, the thing about the dopamine receptors that is crucial here. So, when we flood them because we have too much dopamine, then our system downregulates and says, yeah, I'm not making so much dopamine.
No.
So then the next normal thing we would normally like doesn't make us happy. But then there's also like damage, cell damage. We lose these receptors, right? So we're jacking up a system that creates...
Wait, because you're flooding them?
Because you're flooding them.
Oh, interesting.
So let me tell you about the flooding and how that works. So our sister, we're going to talk about her one more time, Tara. She did meth for a lot of time.
She did do some meth.
And she was never completely addicted, which is shocking.
Yeah.
But I'm sure there's other things going on there. But I was talking to her about this the other day. Like, tell me about your use. Like, you know, the first time you used it.
The fact that you guys can
like
even have that conversation is
a miracle.
Just about a miracle. Yeah.
I know, right?
Anyway,
so we were talking about, and I'm telling her this stuff, and sort of in very different words, but.
Right.
But if you look at the studies of brain dopamine levels that shoot through the brain with certain activities, it's kind of crazy, the numbers. So good food you love,
sure.
You know, whatever, it's a 50% increase or spike in dopamine. Okay. Sex is 100% spike in dopamine. That's real sex. That's not porn sex.
Not porn sex.
In case you're wondering. nicotine is 225% spike in dopamine. There is a reason that stuff is so addictive.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Cocaine, 400%.
Okay.
Meth, 1,100%.
1,100%.
Yeah.
1,100%.
Which is why people who are addicted to meth don't eat.
Yeah.
They don't have sex. They don't sleep. Nothing is like a 1,100% spike of dopamine.
Wow.
And that's why they get all crazy and look terrible and die. I mean, it is the most addictive thing, at least that we know of. But it's because dopamine, I mean, it's literally blasting their brain, blasting it, right?
Right.
So then you get loss of receptors, all the proteins that do all sorts of stuff start to get killed off. Anyway, it gets crazy. And you lose your natural ability to feel good. So here's, we go back to this.
Right, when it goes away, then you feel terrible.
Terrible.
Awful.
So the withdrawals, nothing feels good.
Right.
You're irritable, you're in pain, you're, you know, it is the worst, right? And that's all drugs. That's, and that includes pornography, people, mm-hmm. not just, or food, or whatever it is, the thing that you were, your use, right?
Or gambling, or whatever.
Or gambling, right. Okay.
Again, we know it's controversial. We get it. It only seems to be controversial for somebody who's watching a lot of porn, though.
I know, right?
I'm not hearing from anyone who isn't that's complaining.
Right.
So
right.
And
the truth is, you can have just a regular, and yes, I'll call it a relationship, a regular relationship with porn, mm-hmm. and not be an addict. And that's
right,
just fine.
Because physiologically, you may be different than people who have whatever.
But you also might be the guy that when your friend has real depression, you're like, just get up and like have a better attitude.
Yeah.
Because your brain is fine.
Right.
But their brain isn't. And there are people with any kinds of addiction. Their brain is just not fine. So
right.
Sobriety is crucial for rebuilding the brain. Mm. So sometimes they're like, well, I'll just do it once a week. Yeah. Or I'll cut down my amount. You cannot get clean.
Or the whole one last time.
One last time business. Or just, you know.
That's true of any of those.
All of them. And it's because.
Drugs, whatever.
You have, your system is so screwed up and downregulated. You have to create a whole new set of stuff.
Yeah.
And it just takes, you know, quite a bit of time. This is interesting. I'm just going to tell you a study about rats.
Oh, man, I love rats.
We use rats a lot.
I had some rats growing up.
So this is what they've figured out.
I have to feed our snake rats in the next couple of years.
So adolescence, you know how I loved it. What? I know.
I'll
tell you which ones to feed them.
All right.
So they took rats in adolescence, and you may not know this about adolescent rats, but they are excruciatingly social. Love to be with each other. They're crazy. They jump off stuff. They are like humans.
Only related or the other rats?
All rats.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just if you're a rat and you're my age, we're hanging out.
You are hanging out. You want to be with other rats.
Okay.
You're always doing fun stuff. Okay. So they take these rats,
yeah.
and they isolate them.
Okay.
Which is like torture for a rat who is an adolescent.
Adolescent rat in a cage by itself.
By itself. And they do like just never let them be around other people / rats.
Okay.
So they're very isolated, which is highly stressful. They can monitor their stress. You know, they have, would they take their little heartbeat? I don't know. But they are stressed out. Okay. And then they take rats who have normal socialization and then the rats who are isolated and they start to give them cocaine. Right?
Oh my gosh.
They give them any kind of drug. I don't know exactly what, but, you know, whatever. And then they do it in certain ways. Like they put them in one box that has striped wallpaper.
Yeah.
And there's the lever for the drug in there. Right.
Yeah.
And then they'll do another form of that. Right. So basically it's creating a memory cue for how I get my drug. So you take these two rats, you give them both cocaine, which they enjoy.
Sounds like a really cruel test on the rat.
Right?
But yeah.
Right.
Carter would hate this. Anyway.
She won't eat rats now. Yeah. So anyway, what they found is when they detox these rats, mm-hmm. so they get them addicted, they detox them, they take these same two rats, so the one who had all the socialization, the other one who had high stress and was isolated, and they put them back in those boxes. And the numbers are shocking.
Really?
That rat who has detoxed and is clean will run right back to that lever in that striped room and just like, give me the cocaine. Yeah. And then the other rats, if we looked at the graph, those rats are right back up and the other ones, you know, can take it or leave it. So what they're looking at is high stress from a young age, how that ultimately is impacting the wiring of our brains.
Yeah.
Granted, these are rats, but we can't quite give cocaine to teenagers.
No, not yet.
But maybe we will. Anyway,
maybe we'll figure it out one day.
So they're finding that there's some genetic stuff that kind of applies there. And then you have some of the nurture stuff, which is high stress, that type of thing. So anyway, it's pretty freaky. And it turns out there's like 56 genes involved in one of, you know, maybe a nicotine addiction or schizophrenia actually has 56 genes involved. So it's not like we can go, you got that one gene, you're going to get schizophrenic. I mean, we're just far from...
If you're telling me that neuroscience, its oldest roots are really in the 90s, I mean, we're hosed.
Yeah, it's freaky.
Like, we're not going to be able to... I feel like that people think we are a lot further along with that stuff than we are.
Mm-hmm.
I think people have an assumption That's all worked out now. Some of the social issues with mental illness are kind of starting to go away. So people see that as, oh, progress, because we've figured everything out, yeah, obviously, because now people know. And it's like smoking. Everyone knows it's bad for you. So right, they must have figured it out, but they haven't really figured it out.
Right.
And all we have are all these indicators, and it's going to be a shifting science kind of thing. And because we live in this hyper side picking society,
yeah,
the minute one of those theories is wrong, a big faction of people are going to be like, see, it's faulty science. Mental illness comes from demon dogs or some other bull crap. You know, like, right, like the argument everyone's having about global warming or anything else. It's just like this big, stupid, political, somehow religious fight.
Yeah, why does it always have to go there?
I don't know. How that stuff gets into religious territory, or at least that kind of rhetoric, I don't get it.
So let's take this example.
Yeah.
You know how in Salt Lake you have these garbage trucks that go by, and they have a picture of like a pile of garbage, yeah, and a teenager that says, you know, don't let your kid drink.
Mm-hmm.
It's garbage on his brain or something like that.
Yeah.
And so you get a lot of, you know, there's a lot of pro education stuff about, you know, younger kids drinking because they're drinking, right? Mm-hmm. And the science supports this idea that if your kid drinks, it's not going to destroy them. But if they binge drink, there's serious risks to that. Because what it does is during that very vulnerable time of their brain development,
yeah,
we have what's called our GABA system, but basically it's how we get calm. Yeah. It's how the whole cortisol thing works. It's how, you know, the reward system works. And if that GABA system is busted, which it gets busted when you binge drink,
yeah,
then there's never a calming ability. Yep. Your brain starts to lose its capacity to do something.
If you abuse benzos, if you take...
Yeah, very similar.
Take a Xanax every 10 minutes or something.
Yeah.
Whatever.
So your brain no longer knows how to sedate itself.
Yeah.
So when we go back to the Diablo thing where you go off and play something, what you're doing is you're creating focus,
yeah,
and you stop the sort of stress system,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But don't you think it's interesting that you do something stressful to do that? Is Diablo not in itself? I'm looking at the Diablo poster and it's terrifying.
It's that's an interesting point. It is. It's funny because you'll never play the game, so you won't really know this, but it's an interesting, that's emblematic of a very specific kind of game that is all about reward, risk and reward. It's all about do a bunch of stuff that's challenging, and you can kind of adjust the challenge. But when you do those things, there is a really good chance you're going to get something awesome.
Yeah.
There's a chance you might get nothing. But there's
and
a
guess
good
what you're getting?
You're getting dopamine.
Dopamine
hits. Oh, absolutely.
So like, what you've done is you've gone from a million projects, no dopamine, no ability to focus,
yeah,
to one thing where there is
clear
dopamine.
Clear goals. I know what I have to do to get it.
Mm-hmm.
I know how long I have to spend doing it to get there.
And there's enough chance that you won't get it that dopamine does get involved.
Correct. Because when you do, you're like, ooh, awesome. This one time I was here, I know how random this is and how hard that is to get that. And that what I did by bumping difficulty up a little bit, I got a real good reward for that. Even I died 6 times, but it was totally worth it because I got this drop of this sweet helmet or whatever that's got all these amazing stats,
right,
on it that I wouldn't have gotten otherwise. It's really, that game is the epitome of that kind of gaming. Now,
yeah,
there's lots of ways
other
to play
options,
games,
right,
and this is just a very specific example.
But it's the rat going back to the room.
It is what I like, though,
yeah,
because I like that.
Of course.
I mean, I can't play for too long. I'll sit down and I'll be like, all right, is that 2 hours? I've got to get out of this, and I'll,
right,
get out. So it's not like a thing where I can't stop. I have friends who can't freaking stop playing.
Right.
And it's not maybe one different game or another game, but for whatever reason, they have escaped into this world of there's the one thing I have to do and this is my reward for doing it.
Yeah.
And nothing else in their life matches that. So they stay away from that.
Right.
For me, it provides, I think the biggest relief of it is it's a thing that doesn't involve anybody else getting on my case about all the list I have to do.
Yeah.
And I can just focus on this thing,
right,
and I can have fun doing it. And it's also a lot of it connected to the work I do and everything. But the bottom line for me is there's no, even knowing that and being a proponent of gameplay and actually thinking we are benefiting, you and I may disagree on some of this, but I think we as a culture will benefit in the long run from this kind of stuff. We're going to have to study it. We're going to have to look at it long term. We're going to have to see what the goods and the bads are. But there's a lot about gameplay and the kind of decision making and the kind of functional stuff you do in games that can positively affect the way people behave, act, know how to work, whatever.
I agree.
All of that stuff being the case, I'm not so naive to not know what's happening in my own head while I'm doing it, which is some may take them to extremes. Right. Some may have no interest at all. But I get a very specific kick out of that kind of game.
Right.
And I know it's happening.
Right.
Now, I'm not assigning negativity to it. Right. I'm not saying this is some big social moray thing. I'm just saying I'm lying if I don't. Because that's the
whole
point.
Enjoy your dopamine.
That's the point of it. Yeah. If it didn't have that, nobody would play it because what's fun? Like what we say is words like fun or in the gameplay way of saying it. It's addicting. That game's so addicting. When we say things like that, we say it flippantly. But what we're really saying is if that thing's fun and I'm really into it, what you're saying is it is rewarding me through my physiological brain chemical response system in a way that is compelling for me to keep doing it.
Right. Which is why we have, you know, we've talked a little bit about this before, but just like a whole season of a show.
Right.
We never have to have the down regulation of the dopamine.
Right.
Until we get to the end and we have to wait for the next. I mean, that used to be a normal part of life, the whatever. And now we have these longer and longer periods of dopamine hits that we then go, no.
And you'll hit at the end of a season and go, and what it is on the surface, it's things like, I have to know if that character really died.
Right.
Or did she really say what she said? I don't know till next April. How am I going to deal with this? But if you boil that down to the physiological math of it all, it's triggering those things in the human brain that want that little piece of closure because that's going to pump your brain full of stuff that makes it feel good.
Which is why we hate movies that end the way we don't want them to end.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they don't give us dopamine hits.
They fly in the face of, you know, when you see Frodo and Sam walking off and toward the mountain and it kind of just ends abruptly in the second movie or whatever.
And you're like, what are you doing?
You keep going. You keep giving me what I need, which is some resolution to this damn story instead of leaving me hanging like this.
So you see a movie when it comes out. I see a movie really far in the future so that then the next one comes out pretty close to that. It's called delayed gratification, I guess. So I don't know. Because I don't like that feeling.
Yeah.
And that's why Breaking Bad, I haven't even started. I now know it's over, so I can start. But there's another thing that happens
depends on
here,
my mood, but yeah.
Is that what is the consequence of 2 hours of playing Diablo? What so to take it full circle, what happened after? You went back to work and what happened?
Well, most of the time it chills me out. So I can go back and I can actually find some focus. So for me, it's a thing where I can finish that and go, all right, shake it off. What are we doing here? All right, we're just going to start with this thing in the top of the list. I'm just going to do it. And I usually find more focus when I've done that. Now, if I'm spending, this doesn't really happen in my life anymore. So it's not really a good comparison. But there have been times where like I would get so sucked into a thing that it's 7 hours later. And Scott emerges after playing.
Right.
I'm useless in that state.
Right.
Nothing seems normal. I don't want to do anything else. I kind of am exhausted. I'm tired. My eyes hurt. It's like, who are you? Like, it's really kind of a fog.
Yeah.
But only, and I haven't done that in so many years, I couldn't even tell you what that's like. But these like brief, it's kind of like naps. They say take no more than 30 minute naps.
Yeah. It's or like you've taken a too long nap.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It kills you. That's how this feels.
Yeah.
I do a quick in and out. You know, hour, let's say 2 hours at the most. And it's kind of refreshing to me.
Yeah.
So I can go back to my stuff. I can get work done. I can focus again. And it feels pretty good.
Right.
But if I'm going for long periods of time or I'm doing it against my better nature, which is I know when I'm tired, I know it's too late, and I'm still doing it, that's just asking for trouble for
me. Well, and I think there's a little litmus test you can do for addiction with a big A, which is it really starts jacking up your life. So you binge for 7 hours on TV every day and you can't get your taxes done and you can't get up for work. Eventually, we're going to have to call it what it is. But if you do it once or twice or every once in a while, it's not the same thing. But you're experiencing sort of what that down regulation feels like a little bit in that moment. Elliot calls it, my five-year-old calls it, I feel fuzzy. He'll watch a show and he'll be done. And I'm like, how was the show? And he'll go, good, but I feel fuzzy. I'm like, all right, that means your brain can't do any more.
Yeah.
And let's go outside. And going outside and jumping on a trampoline fixes brain fuzz, by the way.
I noticed that yesterday after a big client nightmare I had to deal with and focus on and get done on time, big, huge deadline, I went out with the dog, walked around the park for about 3 miles
Yeah.
out by the lake. Amazing. just cleared it right up, man. Yeah. Just felt great when I got back. So, yeah, I mean, all this stuff, some of it seems maybe obvious to some people, but there are people who, if what they're doing is so compelling that that's all they do, I mean, there have been times where crunch time, whatever it is I have to do in crunch time that takes a ton of focus for a long time, even if it's just straight up work, I can't not dream about it.
Yeah.
And when I'm dreaming about that stuff, or even games, like if I play a bunch of games, like I remember as kids, dad of those arcade games, I'd play Galaga all night. Go to bed, dream about Galaga all night long. And it sucks. You can't get a good rest. None of it makes sense. There's weird stuff in there that aren't really in the game. You wake up going, did that really happen? Like, it's obvious that my brain is like,
yeah,
no, we still got this. Still on the fringe of everything. Yeah. You know, we haven't released it yet.
Right.
I feel like you could do a whole show on that.
You could. And let me just do one more plug for exercise. I mean, it is hands down the most well-researched, solid response to this. It helps
even little
depression
stuff, right?
Anxiety. It helps because what it does, it's one of the down regulators. It helps.
You don't have to bench 250 to do what you're talking
about.
You
just gotta move your butt a little bit every day. And I think that's, if you think about your average day, if you haven't moved at all, but you've sat, I mean, sitting is gonna kill us. Yeah. Sitting is standing, walking.
So I have a standing desk, but as you can see, I've been sitting this entire
time. I know, but sitting is, you know, we're just not meant to sit.
Yeah.
And so it really has a huge play in the brain to exercise. Mm-hmm. And what's difficult is when someone's so depressed they can't get out of bed, it's hard to say, no, you should exercise. But it is crucial for sort of managing this whole system. So it's a really good thing. And I think nature has, I would assume most people would agree with me here, but just has its own ability. Fresh air, light color, just natural world stuff can really...
Seasons that rejuvenate.
Yeah.
And
really make a difference.
That's a good point. I mean, some may take it as hippie logic, but I think there's something to it.
Go hug a tree and tell me.
Go hug a tree, then tell me how that felt. Lacerations and bark marks. Well, I think that'll do it for this episode. Nice, long, hefty, meaty one.
Yeah, wow. Sorry.
But they're big topics. So I think people enjoy those. Your feedback, always welcome. You can send emails to, send them to me, scott@frogpants.com. And check out frogpants.com/therapy. That's where we'll put links to other stuff, things that are going on, our email address, Twitter feeds, all that kind of stuff. You're probably already doing that anyway. We'll be back next time with a whole new episode about a whole new thing. We'll see you guys then. Thanks, Wendy.
You're welcome, Scott.
Bye, everybody.